Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. Thanks again for listening. 888-914-9149. I have a note that came in from Rachel. She says, Patrick, thanks. You've made such a positive impact on my life. One such positive note is inspiring me to commit to praying the rosary every day. I heard you talk with a woman asking about annulments, and I thought you mentioned that more recently in history we have a malformation in development leading to narcissism and selfishness. That resonated with me. I'm a millennial mom and wife, and I was wondering if you could expand on this idea and how to not be negatively influenced and how to guide our children away from these things which are so toxic in our culture. My thought is the obsession with self-image social media promotes and the constant noise of our culture and how these are major culprits. I would appreciate any thoughts or book recommendations on resources focusing on marriage and parenting in a disordered world. Thank you. Well, gosh, thank you, Rachel. I am a big fan of the parenting advice that Steve Wood gives in his books and his podcast and his DVDs and such. So rather than try to kind of go through a list of all the different things, I would say go to his website. It's dads.org. And look at some of the books. One particular book I like, it's called Legacy, and it's a book about how to raise godly children, not just boys, not just dads and boys, but moms, dads, and their kids, how to raise godly children. And having had some experience of trying to do that myself for nearly 42 years now, 11 children, I think that a lot of what Steve Wood has to say in his books is true, because I've seen the truth of some of the things that he talks about. So I would go there. I would check in with maybe Mike and Alicia Hernan. They have a thing called the Messy Family Project. Just Google it. I don't happen to have their website in front of me. But they have some resources as well to try to help families navigate through this world with all of the different toxic shoals that are out there. You don't want to crash into those. You want to navigate around them and go past them. And they've got some good examples and suggestions on how to do that. Their names again, Mike and Alicia Hernan, H-E-R-N-O-N. Thank you. And I'm so glad to hear that you've committed to praying the rosary every day. That makes me really happy. I'll just, for good measure, mention that, and I'm just speaking generally to all of you, you make time for what's important to you, don't you? We all do. If there's a particular show that you like, you're going to make time to watch that show. If there's a particular hobby or pastime, gardening, golf, walking, reading, what have you, you're going to make time to do that. So my humble advice would be make some time to pray the rosary every day. We have the Family Rosary Across America every evening at 7 p.m. You can pray along with Father Rocky and Margaret Kleinschmidt, who lead the whole world in praying the rosary. It's a beautiful thing. If you've never tuned in, I encourage you to do so. And maybe that can be your time. Maybe it's after dinner and, you know, you want to settle the kids down, or maybe you're no longer parenting kids because they're all grown up. Well, maybe that can be a nice quiet time for you. You grab your rosary, turn on Family Rosary Across America. But my point is, make a commitment to pray the rosary every day. Just like you wouldn't go to bed at night without brushing your teeth. At least I hope you wouldn't. I can't imagine anybody being willing to go to bed without having brushed his or her teeth first. It's just something you do, and you wouldn't think to go to bed without doing that. So I really want to encourage you for a couple of reasons. Number one, and maybe this is the most important reason, is that if you pray the rosary every day, you will be doing what Our Lady is asking and pleading with us to do for well over 100 years now, in terms of her apparition at Fatima, for example, and other apparitions, saying, pray the rosary, pray the rosary. She doesn't say, go to Bible studies, read the Liturgy of the Hours. These are all good things. She doesn't say that. She says, pray the rosary. So the one fundamental thing you can do, it'll take you about 15 minutes if you want to do it prayerfully, not clickety-clack, but to do it prayerfully thoughtfully, it'll take you about 15 minutes. Less time than to watch your favorite TV show. Less time than to watch a movie. Less time than to do just about anything else you're going to make time to do that's important to you. It takes less time to pray the rosary. That's the first thing. Second thing is, it's a great weapon against vice. Now, not just vice out there, but also vice inside here. So if you look at the garden of your soul and you see a lot of weeds, well, the rosary is like a weed whacker. And if you get in the habit of praying the rosary every day, 15 minutes prayerfully, thinking about what you're doing, meditating on the life of Jesus, meditating on all these different gospel accounts, which is what the mysteries of the rosary do. They focus on the life of Christ and what's happening in the Bible. Not to mention the prayers of the rosary come almost verbatim out of the Bible for the most part. The traditional rosary with the three traditional mysteries, the sorrowful mystery, the glorious mystery, the joyful mystery, those are patterned after the 150 Psalms of the Old Testament, in which there was quite a bit of repetition, by the way, praying the same refrain over and over again in the Psalms. The Holy Spirit inspired that. But when you make a commitment to pray the rosary every day, you will find it's like taking a weed whacker to the weeds in your soul garden. It really is. And it's hard to explain it, but if, let's say that you struggle with a particular sin, could be lust, could be pride, could be gluttony, could be whatever it is, if you start praying the rosary every day, prayerfully, 15 minutes a day, you will notice a change for the better in that besetting sin, that predominant fault, whatever it is. You're going to start seeing it get better, because it's like, if I can mix metaphors here, and I'll change it from the weed whacker metaphor to the Roundup metaphor. It's like spraying Roundup on the weed, and eventually that weed will die. And what replaces that is the virtue that the vice is opposing. So the virtues of purity or meekness or all the other virtues that we're called to cultivate will flourish in the garden of your soul if you're in the habit of weeding it on a daily basis by praying the rosary. Then the last thing is, if you pray the rosary and you make a commitment to praying the rosary every day, here's another wonderful side effect. Maybe you experience a reoccurring fault, a recurring sin. And maybe it's a sin in your life, of whatever type, doesn't matter, that you have no success in getting free from. And you always fall back into the same sin. Sometimes it takes longer, sometimes it takes less time, but eventually you fall back into that same sin again. And you want freedom. I can tell you, if you pray the rosary every day, you will find it. Because if you have this commitment, I'm going to pray the rosary today, no matter what. I'm not going to go to sleep tonight before I pray the rosary. It becomes really difficult to fall into whatever these sins may be, because you realize, well, I'm going to still have to pray the rosary. And I don't want to be praying the rosary and at the same time be dabbling in sins of greed or pride or any of the other sins. They have a way of canceling each other out. And what happens is you're just not going to want to commit these sins because you've made a commitment to praying the rosary. It's interesting how it works. And it does work. Believe me, it works. So try it. If you haven't gotten in the habit of praying the rosary every day, that's my heartfelt encouragement to you today. If your life is bleak, if you've got family strife, if you're fearful, if you have whatever it may be, ask Our Lady to help you. And she's saying to you, here's how I want you to ask me to help you. Pray the rosary. Invoke my intercession through the rosary. It's a powerful biblical prayer. Do this, and I promise you I'm going to be there to help you. So take her at her word. Maybe today's that day for you. And you make the commitment. I am going to commit to praying the rosary every day for the rest of my life. And I'm never gonna miss a day ever again for the rest of my life. I can guarantee you, if you make that decision, whether it's today or at some point down the road, but why defer it? Your life will change and your life will get better. It may not get easier, but it will certainly get better. That much I'm certain Our Lady can promise you, and take her up on that and just test it for yourself. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Mary now in California. Hi, Mary.
Hello. Thank you.
Yeah.
I have a question about marriage.
Yes.
If a person, one is Catholic and the other one isn't, and they married in the Presbyterian church, is that marriage valid?
Well, it's going to be if you say that one person is Catholic and
right,
the other person
and has all
is,
the sacraments, uh-huh.
Okay, and the other person is not a Catholic but is, let's say, Presbyterian?
Like he's really no religion. I don't know if he was baptized okay. when he was young, but I imagine he was
okay.
in the Catholic Church. But he never followed, never went to church or anything like okay. that.
Well, here's the short answer to the question. This is something that you would need a canon lawyer to poke around and get a few more details in there. But on the surface of it, we could say, no, it would not be a valid marriage because the Catholic party has the obligation and the requirement to get married according to what's called the church's canonical form, which stipulates that a Catholic needs to get married outside of getting permission from the bishop. And that can be obtained. But assuming that the Catholic party did not seek a dispensation, the church requires that the Catholic get married in a Catholic church and that this wedding be duly witnessed by either a priest, a deacon, or a bishop. Now, there are extreme circumstances where the church's law would make provision for somebody to get married in a different way, but under normal circumstances, that's required. So in order for the marriage to be, let me just add, Mary, in order for the marriage to be valid, as far as the church is concerned, it would need to be according to the canonical form. So if a Catholic ignores that and doesn't get married that way, then the presumption is that that's an invalid marriage for that reason.
And they told her at the time that she could not go to a Catholic church. So
who's
she was
they?
Going to this Protestant church. The priest told her that.
Well, see, that's where it might get a little bit detailed because who knows what the reasons were why he told her this. Maybe the man she wanted to marry was a cousin. And so the law that you can't get married to somebody that closely related to you, it could have been any number of things. But that's where if you're concerned about, maybe this is your daughter, for example, I would sit down and talk to your local parish priest, and he, if necessary, can put you in touch with the marriage tribunal, could answer more questions. I hope that's helpful, Mary. Thank you. Also, a good website, if you're interested in doing a little bit of searching for these topics, is called Canon Law Made Easy, canonlawmadeeasy.com by a canon lawyer. Her name is Kathy Caridi, and she spends a lot of time writing articles that go into much more detail on topics just like this one. So check that out, Canon Law Made Easy. Let's go to Cynthia now in San Marcos, Texas. And I think San Marcos is the home of Schlitterbahn, isn't it, Cynthia?
Well, I think it's in New Braunfels. Hi, my friend.
Oh, you're right.
And that's
you're
just,
right.
That's just right down the street. That's not very far. I think it's about 15, 20 minutes.
Got
and
it. Okay.
I haven't been there. I'm kind of busy, so I put the sprinkler on in my yard. Anyway, Patrick, I work in a very well-known pancake restaurant, and I work with a lot of young people, and I'm kind of like a mom on the good side and on when I get on their nerve side too with the cussing, the music they're listening to, and probably about half of them, I would say, about are baptized Catholics, but not practicing and probably never catechized. A young man recently was asking me if I believe in something. He was trying to explain to me. I thought he was talking about purgatory. Turns out he was asking me about the rapture. And it kind of threw me, and I know that as a Catholic, we don't believe in that, but I was stuck as to giving him a solid, good explanation of what we do believe and why the rapture is not what we believe. Because I see that some of these guys and ladies I work with, young men and women, are searching. And so sometimes they do come to me, and I pray for them every day. I try to be a good spiritual mom to them. Even when, and I'm always looking for that God door that you have so aptly put and described, and it works. So can you help me out with this today?
I'd be happy to. Thank you. And I'm so happy for you that you're in a position to be able to give good influence to these young people that you're talking about. Well, let's begin at the beginning. It may surprise you to know, Cynthia, that the Catholic Church does indeed teach that there will be a rapture. The Bible does teach that there will be a rapture. But what the church says is that... Yeah, so I'll lay it out for you. What the church says also, though, is that the popular notion of a pre-tribulation rapture, that is definitely not biblical. This notion that's very prevalent among many Protestants, that prior to the Great Tribulation and the rise of the Antichrist and the persecution that will ensue, that God is going to rapture all the true believers off the face of the earth and everybody else will be left behind, to coin a phrase, and that's where the Left Behind books get their title. That's not true. That's not biblical. But let's start with what the Bible actually does say about this issue. And it says so in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, and I'll read it to you. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a cry of command and with the archangel's call and with the sound of the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive, who are left, shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And so we shall always be with the Lord. Now that word, this is just a little arcane detail for your good to know file, but that word in Latin, when it says in English to be caught up, the word in Latin is rapiemur. And that is the word that St. Jerome used to translate the Greek term, and it means to be caught up or to be snatched away. We get the word in English, rape, or rapture from that word. It doesn't mean that it's referring to rape. That's another derivation. But that word, to be caught up, is how this is where the word rapture in English comes from St. Jerome, a Catholic Bible translator who translated the Greek and Hebrew scriptures into Latin under the command of Pope Damasus I. This is at the end of the 4th century. Pope Damasus I told St. Jerome to make this translation so that the greatest number of people who were literate, in the West anyway, who understood Latin, could read the Bible. So it's there that the term rapture comes from. And that's when the rapture actually will take place. So those are the people who will still be alive and who are destined for heaven. When the Lord returns, there will be some people still alive on the earth. How many there will be, we don't know. But they will be raptured. They will be caught up in the air, and they will be translated from mortality into immortality. How that will happen, it doesn't tell us. But you know, we're also told that in a twinkling of an eye, that will take place. So that's the real rapture. That's what the Bible talks about, and we can all say a hearty amen. But it's been twisted by evangelical commentators and others into this notion that before the tribulation starts, that the church or true believers are going to be raptured and taken out of the world. But listen to what Jesus says in John chapter 17, in his high priestly prayer. This is in verse 15, Jesus says, quote, I do not pray that thou shouldest take them out of the world, but that thou shouldest keep them from the evil one. And in John 16:33, he says, in the world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer, for I have overcome the world. And in John 15, verse 19, Jesus says that we as Christians have been chosen out of the world, but it doesn't say that we will be taken out of the world. As it says, we are in the world, but not of the world. So all of the verses that are brought forward trying to prove this so-called pre-tribulation rapture, they all refer to the end of the world, as it says in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. So Matthew chapter 24, verses 37 and forward. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 51 and forward. Revelation chapter 3, verse 10. Revelation chapter 4, verses 1 and 2. All the standard verses that people bring forward to try to promote the idea of a hidden secret rapture that takes place before the tribulation, none of those things are talking about that. They're all talking about the tribulation or the post-tribulation and the second coming of Jesus. That's when the rapture will happen, and that's what the Catholic Church teaches. And I'm just about out of time. So does that help you?
Well, yes, it actually does. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And
you're
have
welcome,
an awesome
Cynthia.
Day. Thank you.
You too. Thank you. Okay, perfect time to jump out, not permanently, but just for a couple minutes. Take a break, and we'll come right back. A line just opened up. 888-914-9149 is the number. I see what you're doing, Thomas, and I like it. I'll be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
That was my cue. 888-914-9149. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Miranda in Alexandria, Minnesota. Hi, Miranda.
Hello, Patrick. Say, my question was, can women become deacons? And why on earth would a retired priest who's substituting at our parish for the Sunday promote that idea?
All right. Well, okay. Some things, they have a tendency to, like a smoldering campfire. They just continue to smolder for a while, and they don't go out when they should, and sometimes that can lead to conflagration. So let's take it in order. The first thing is that in the Holy Bible, there is a mention of a deaconess, and this is something that we'll come back to in a minute. But in Romans chapter 16, verse 1, to use one example, Paul refers to Phoebe. He says, I commend to you our sister Phoebe, a deaconess of the church at Cenchreae. And the mention of deaconesses in the New Testament has given rise to a belief that this is the order, this is the entry level to the sacrament of holy orders, the same as men who are ordained to either the permanent diaconate or the transitional diaconate if they're on their way to being ordained priests. And that's not what it's referring to. So if you want a lengthy answer, I would get a book called Deaconesses in the Early Church. And it's published by Ignatius Press. Deaconesses, I want to get the name of the author so that you can look it up. But I will get that for you here in just a second. But that book gives an historical, first of all, a biblical and historical survey of this office of deacon. What was it? What did these women do? And what was the way in which they would be inducted into this cadre known as deaconesses? So it's called Deaconesses, an Historical Study. And the author's last name is Martimort, M-A-R-T-I-M-O-R-T, Martimort, as we would say it in English. So that's a book that's going to provide an exhaustive overview of the evidence from Scripture and also in the early church. So I can summarize it by saying there is plenty of evidence that there were, in fact, women who were called deaconesses that were inducted into a special group that was intended to serve other women primarily, and in particular, like in the sacraments, especially the sacrament of baptism. And there are a few practical reasons for this, because it was common in the early church to baptize by immersion. And so when a woman is going to be immersed in the water and her garments, to the extent that she would have probably been wearing just something very minimal, like a white garment or something like that, it's going to cling to the body. And men being men and women being women, this was seen as an opportunity for lust or an opportunity for other problems. And so the early church had this special group of women who would minister to those women who were going to be baptized. And this is just one example. It's not the only one. But for a practical reason, it was seen as a wise decision not to have men baptizing women under those kind of circumstances, just to avoid the possibility of problems. They were very similar, I think we could say, to religious sisters today. In fact, in the early canons of some of the early councils, it stipulates what the ages are for women who could be inducted as a deaconess. And it was, they were elderly women typically. Now, forgive my use of the word elderly, because the older I get, that term elderly has changed in meaning for me. And what I deem to be elderly now is not what I used to think of is elderly. But the age of 60 was one of those, you know, markers that younger women were not typically involved in this group. It would be women who were older. And the reason for that is they were typically widows by that point. And so they no longer had to worry about raising children. They had no longer had to worry about taking care of their husband back at home. They were more free, as St. Paul talks about, to be single-minded in the service of the Lord. But the real issue is that they were not given the sacrament of holy orders. They were not inducted into the diaconate the way men are for the sacrament of holy orders. Pope John Paul II, he issued a document called Ordinatio Sacerdotalis, which is Latin for on priestly ordination. And he said very succinctly and very specifically, this is never going to happen in the church. Women are not admitted to holy orders. And that's the way Jesus established it. And we as the church do not have the power to override Jesus. And he answered in bullet point format all of the standard arguments against the church's teaching. Well, that was just the patriarchy speaking. And Jesus was, he was shaped, his attitudes were shaped by the patriarchy. And Pope John Paul II blows that out of the water, as he does with the other arguments. But he concludes by saying that I, you know, confirm, and he uses very specific language to say, this is not going to happen, so all of the agitating should stop because it's a moot point. Now, as to the second part of your question, why would a deacon agitate for something that Pope John Paul II has said it's not going to happen? Well, because like that smoldering campfire, there are some people who just will not let go of this thing. And they're agitating and agitating and agitating and agitating and agitating because they want something there that the Holy Father has already said, that's not going to happen. That door is closed. The church doesn't have that authority. So without knowing what was going on in the mind of the person who said this, I can surmise that it was probably something along those lines. Interesting question, Miranda, and I appreciate your phone call. Thank you. Let's go now to Juan listening in San Francisco. Good morning, Juan.
Hey, Patrick. Good morning.
Good morning.
So my question is, I'm 44 years old. I always have experienced same-sex attraction. Mm-hmm. And I'm attending Courage. I started seeing a therapist, a Catholic therapist, last week. I read the book, The Courage to be Chased by, you know, Benedict Rochelle.
Okay.
But I still feel that it's just, I don't know. And I stay close to the sacraments, but I feel mm-hmm. like it's just a struggle.
Yeah.
To be chased.
I can understand. Yeah.
So I don't know if you have any advice. So I don't know.
Yeah, I can understand. I can and I can't because I don't have same-sex attraction. But for what it's worth, Juan, I mean, as somebody who's opposite-sex attracted, I can understand the feelings of the raw feeling of being attracted to a person sexually and really at times even having a very strong attraction and yet realizing that I can't act on that. I can't do something because she's not my wife. And before I was married, you know, she's not my wife. So we are all called to holiness, to virtue, so chastity, purity, etc. That's true for same-sex attracted people as it is for opposite-sex attracted people like me. We're all called to that. So it's a common human experience, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. So number one, I want to encourage you by reminding you that you're not alone and that you're not unique. And I don't mean that in a bad way or a dismissive way. What I mean is that you're like all the rest of us, is that you have to make a daily decision. Am I going to follow Jesus? And am I going to avoid doing those things that I know will disrupt my life with him? Or am I going to fall into those sins? So it's a daily struggle, a daily decision that we all have to make. But what happens is, you know that phrase, it gets better, Juan? It's used by many people in the LGBTQ community. I'm sure you've heard it before, mm-hmm. right? It gets better.
Yeah.
Well, it actually is true, but it's true in this sense. The real truth is in this sense, is that when you are struggling to obtain the virtue of chastity and purity, it is like lifting weights. Now think about this for a minute. At first, when you first come to it, it's like hard to lift the weights because you're not used to it. And your muscles hurt the next day and the next day and the next day and the next day. But after a while, what happens is you build up the capacity to be able to lift the weights. Your muscles grow stronger. The pain begins to go away. And before you know it, you have gotten to the point where you can do this because you have developed the ability to do it. And virtue is the same kind of thing, where at first it's difficult and it hurts and you just, why am I doing this? I don't want to do this. It'd be so much easier to do the opposite. But like with anything else, learning how to play the piano, lifting weights, any other thing, you develop what's called a stable disposition, where it does get easier and easier and easier. And so I just want to encourage you in that even though right now it may seem bleak, over time it will get easier and it will be less of a struggle. That much I know for sure, because the saints show us this by their example. Are you plugged in? You mentioned courage. Are you plugged into a parish? I mean, are you nourishing your faith life with Mass and the sacraments?
Yes, of course. I'm registered at a parish. I go to Mass every Sunday. I go during the week. Sometimes That's I attend good. Their morning or evening prayer, because it's a Dominican parish, so they do the vespers and morning prayer. Oh, so I'm a Saint Claus for the sacraments, and if it weren't for that, it would have been worse. But yes.
That's
but no,
good.
I thank you for your words of encouragement. You're right. This is a daily decision where I'm going to follow Jesus or, you know, my passions, mm-hmm. and just develop, keep like a working out, keep developing that virtue of chastity.
Yes.
And
you know, there is something called, and you should ask the Dominican friars about this, Juan. It's called the Confraternity of Angelic Warfare. Have you heard of that?
Yeah, actually, one of the Dominicans is my spiritual director, and he mentioned that to me once, and I enrolled about 4 or 5 months ago, and that has been a great help. And
good.
Yes, so I am enrolled in that, and I do my 15 Hail Marys with the specific intentions, and that has been an unbelievable help.
That's good. What about your work situation? Because obviously San Francisco, its reputation precedes it. Do you find that you're in a situation, whether it's in work or just day-to-day life, where you're surrounded by temptations, or are you able to insulate yourself from that somewhat?
My work is okay. I work mostly from home, so that's not an issue. But of course, when I had to go about my daily life and you go outside, and it's on your face. But like anybody living in a city, right? You always see people outside, and that's mainly the temptation. Yeah, I mean, I made it through pride, you know, walking around and seeing rainbow flags and all that all the time. So.
I bet. Yeah. And where you live is especially concentrated. The rosary, is that part of your life?
I haven't been doing it lately, but I was doing it daily, but now I'm slacking off a little bit. But in my routine, I do the morning offering when I wake up, and I do my 15 Hail Marys, and then I try to go to, you know, daily Mass as much as I can, and on Sunday Mass, of course. And I listen to the Relevant Radio, your show, Inner Life. I'm doing my best.
Sounds like you are. I mean, there's really no advice I can give you that you haven't already taken, but I just want to give you encouragement, Juan.
Yes, you did that better.
Yeah. Are you familiar with a book called Father Elijah?
No. What's the name of the book?
Yeah, it's called Father Elijah. Now, I want to share something with you, because I think this might help you, just at least give you some more encouragement. This is a book by Michael O'Brien, and it's set in the present day. And I'll just give you a little bit of what this is about, but it would be a book well worth your time reading, and there's a reason why that I'll share with you in a minute. It's a book about how the Pope calls out of obscurity this Carmelite monk who's actually living and working and praying in the Carmel that is on top of Mount Carmel, just above the city of Haifa in northern Israel. And it's like, well, what does the Pope want to talk to me about? So he goes there, and the Pope tells him that he has identified the Antichrist, and he knows who the Antichrist is. And he sends Father Elijah on a mission to try to convert the Antichrist, to try to evangelize the Antichrist, to stop being the Antichrist. That's what the whole book is about. And it's a powerful, very, very interesting book. I think you'll enjoy it. But here's the reason I'm referencing that book. There is a character in that book, and I can't tell you anything more, but there's a character in the book who is heroic and selfless in his love for a 14-year-old boy. This is during World War II when that part takes place. And the man who is selfless and heroic is homosexual. And he is deeply, deeply, deeply struggling with the desire to act upon his impulses, and he doesn't. But the way that story unfolds is really edifying. And I think if you read that, given your own, your own struggles, I think you would see in that character something really beautiful and something encouraging.
Great. Thank you, Patrick. I will get the book, and I will probably email you and I'll follow up.
I would look forward to it.
Thank you. Thank you for everything. Thank you to Relevant Radio, to you. I think it was God sent, because this is the first time I ever called a radio show and your show. And then I went through. So that's obviously God working. And so thank you. Thank you, Cyrus. And
you're
thank
welcome.
You, everyone.
Thanks, Juan. Maybe call me back in a month or two and let me know what you think of the book. I'd sure look forward to it.
Will do.
Okay, have a good thanks, day. Juan. God bless you. Hang in there. It does get better. God promises that it will get better, and it will. I'll be right back right after this.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
Let's get back to it. We'll go to Noah now in Wheaton, Illinois. Hi, Noah. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on.
Sure.
So I've called, once, maybe about a month ago now. I'm considering Catholicism, having been Protestant my whole life. A lot of beautiful things I love about it that are compelling me to it. One of my questions has been, so Catholics teach that if you mortally sin, you need to go to confession for that sin. And I know you mentioned in one of your shows recently, if a Protestant's committed mortal sin, they've lost their salvation.
I'd like a chance to refine that, because I want to make sure that you don't misunderstand what I would have said. But go ahead and finish your question, Noah.
Okay, yeah. So my question was, if a Protestant doesn't know that a sin is mortal, or doesn't know the difference between mortal and venial sin, and also relating to that, if they don't know that they need to go to confession for that mortal sin, how would that work in terms of them losing their salvation? Because that seems like it's a situation where they don't really know.
Right.
Yeah, where it seems like God would be gracious to them.
Right. Well, one thing I love to think about, Noah, is that, as it says in 1 Timothy chapter 2, that God wills the salvation of all people. He wants all men to come to a knowledge of the truth and be saved. So we know that God desires our salvation, and he gives us all of the graces necessary to be saved. We call it, in the Catholic Church, we call it sufficient grace. it's not necessarily efficient for any given person. Some people, the effect of God's sufficient grace doesn't happen for them, like if they refuse it, for example. But we can say, and maybe this is a good starting point, that he's providing sufficient grace for you and all Protestants, all people, Catholics too, to be saved. So what's necessary? Well, the Catholic Church says that if a person knows that this is true, and by this I mean that the Catholic Church is necessary to be saved, meaning to be a Catholic, and this goes back to what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 28, go into the whole world and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I've commanded you. And behold, I'm with you always, even until the end of the age or the end of the world. So this great commission is not to go found Christianity in general, the sort of amorphous idea of a movement, but rather a specific church that Christ has established, and he wants everybody to be a member of that church. And the doorway into the church, you might say, is through baptism. And then the church has the authority to teach the things that the Lord wants us to believe. And we are called to listen to them, listen to the teachers. So as Jesus says in Luke 10:16, he who listens to you listens to me. He who rejects you rejects me. So he was speaking there to the apostles, the first bishops. So with that as our premise, we could say that in a case, and I don't know if you want to use yourself as an example, but if you honestly, through no fault of your own, didn't realize that, you never knew that, then what the Catholic Church says is that in a way that God alone would know, he can indeed give you sanctifying grace. Now, we can say for the sake of discussion that you're already baptized, but the Church says that if somebody, and we can use a Catholic as an example, if the Catholic is in the state of mortal sin and is aware of that and doesn't have an opportunity to go to the sacrament of confession and is in the position of being sorry for his sins, we would call it perfect contrition, meaning that you're truly sorry for your sins more out of love for God than out of fear of punishment. I think we all have some fear of punishment, or we should. But to be truly contrite would be, Lord, I'm sorry for all of my sins because I love you and because you do not deserve to be sinned against, and I'm sorry for all the sins that I committed. The Church says that in a case of a Catholic, that person would be saved even though he had not gone to confession and confessed his mortal sins. If when he dies, he has this attitude, this conviction of his heart that he loves the Lord, he's trusting in the Lord for his salvation, and he's sorry for his sins. So we can say, by implication, that in the case of a Protestant who never really knew, he didn't, it just for whatever reason, it never clicked, that if he had that same contrition, sorrow for sin, trusting in the Lord, the Church says that that person too could be saved. But it also says that if the person knows that he should be Catholic and through negligence or laziness or fear of what other people might think or any of those other things refuses to enter into the church. At Vatican II, Second Vatican Council document Lumen Gentium says that person cannot be saved. And by the way, it says it in the same breath that it talks about Catholics who leave the church also, if they know the church is necessary for salvation, that they too cannot be saved. So it's a message of hope and encouragement, but it's also a reminder that there is the real danger that somebody could just not do what Jesus wants and be lost as a result.
Yeah, that's helpful to think about. So in other words, then I'm understanding you saying that if there is ignorance there, then God is gracious. God is not going to punish someone just because they didn't know they had to go to confession or because they didn't know about the idea of mortal sin. Then, right?
Yeah, so it's the best way to put it is it's what's called invincible ignorance. That's a term you'll see in Catholic literature. It means that it's unconquerable by the person. He's not at fault for his ignorance. He didn't know. And because, as it says in 1 Timothy chapter 2, it says that God desires all men to be saved and come to a knowledge of the truth. Well, there must be some way that could happen. Doesn't mean it will happen in any given case, but it must be at least possible. So that biblical principle applies in this case, that for somebody who genuinely never had the opportunity to know and therefore can't be held accountable for rejecting something that he never knew was required, that God's love for that person and his desire for him to be saved would provide some way for that to happen that hasn't been revealed to us. It's outside the norm. The norm is to be baptized and enter into the church, the Catholic Church. But there are some people for whom that's not possible.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that relates also to this one analogy that a Protestant friend of mine gave me, where you have two guys who grew up in the faith, were following Jesus, and then they fell away. Each one of them committed some grave mortal sin, in full knowledge that it was mortal sin. Like they murdered someone on the street, and then one guy has 5 seconds where he goes, "What have I just done?" and repents, and then gets hit by a car and dies. And then the other guy doesn't. He doesn't repent. And he asked me, "What's the difference between them? How do you know if either one of them would be saved?" So that kind of answers that, helps to answer that question then.
Right. I would recommend, if you want to get kind of a clear understanding of this, read section 14. I mean, read the whole document if you have time to do it, but read section 14 of the document called Lumen Gentium. The first word is L-U-M-E-N. The second word is Gentium, G-E-N-T-I-U-M. And it's available online. Just type that phrase in, and then you can zip down to section 14 where it spells it out. But this is a document on the church herself. In other words, it's a statement by the Catholic Church about what is the church? What is it here for? How did it get here? What does it do? And this section deals with why is it necessary for salvation? So at least, if nothing else, to clarify in your own mind what it is that the Catholic Church is claiming here, I think that would be a good place to see it in black and white. But, you know, again, talk about hope and encouragement. The door is open, Noah, and you are freely invited to become a Catholic. I think listening to this program and other relevant radio programs will be helpful. At least it'll help add more information as you ponder this. You're on the journey, perhaps. I would get a copy of the book called Surprised by Truth. It has stories of people who made that journey, and you may find their stories that they may speak to you. I edited the book, so that's my connection with it. But you can get a cheapo copy off the internet for, you know, peanuts and still get all the same information. But things like that will help you. The Coming Home Network, chnetwork.org is their website, chnetwork.org. They specialize in helping people who are on the journey with materials and articles and testimonials and books. In fact, the head of the organization, Marcus Grodi, who's been a friend of mine for many years, he has a television program called The Journey Home. And for, it must by now be 25 years that he's been doing the show, he has countless people who have been on the program to talk about their own experiences from all various backgrounds, including throughout every aspect of Protestantism. And those are available online or at their website. You can watch these videos and let some of these people talk to you about their own experience of becoming Catholic. So I would encourage you to really investigate and look at these things. Watch you'll be listening to the video of Dr. Scott Hahn's testimony from 1989, The Conversion of a Protestant Minister. It's on YouTube. And it'll help you clarify your thinking as you ponder these questions.
Yeah, thank you so much for all of that. I'll be sure to look into that.
Okay, good. Well, I'm here for you, and if you want to call me back down the road, I'd love to see how things are going.
I sure will. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Noah. God bless you. Let's go to Sandy now in New York. Good morning, Sandy.
Good morning.
Yes, how can
hi,
I
Patrick.
Help?
I'm not sure you're familiar with what a DNR means.
Yeah, do not resuscitate.
And the hospitals. Right. I'm a proxy of a person in church who is sick, terminally ill. And I have noticed twice she's been in a hospital and kind of neglecting to even get the IV on because she doesn't want to find the DNR. And they insist. She was in the hospital a couple of months ago. And they basically neglected her. Mm-hmm. So my question to you, to me it's difficult because she does have family, but she trusted me to make the decisions for her. She thinks, she speaks. Sometimes she's not that lucid in the mind. What my responsibility is without, you know, what the church says, what is the moment where I said, that's it, I have to stop and just let it be, let it go.
Okay,
she
how old is she?
To get resuscitated. Mm-hmm. She is 48.
Okay. Here's what I'd like you to do. First of all, it's good that you're trying to stick up for your friend, and you should. She has the right to be resuscitated. She has the right to receive medical care. And if they don't like the fact that she wants that and they're neglecting her as a result of that, well, shame on them. I mean, that's deeply wrong for them to do that. Maybe it needs...
Yeah,
maybe
even
it's
the doctor
that she,
comes.
Mm-hmm. Maybe she needs to change from where she is to a different place that will show more compassion to her. But what I'd suggest that you do is get in touch with the National Catholic Bioethics Center. Do you have a pen? I'll give you their website. You ready?
Oh, okay.
Jot this down. ncbcenter.org. ncbcenter.org. It stands for National Catholic Bioethics Center. They have a special section on end-of-life issues. So when you go there, you've got a section on advanced directives, living wills, do not resuscitate issue. They have a fact sheet. They have documents. They have summaries. There are a lot of PDF documents and articles. Most all of that is for free. And you can access that to be knowledgeable about what your rights are, what her rights are, and how you can advocate for her rights. I would strongly encourage you to do so. But that's where you're going to find all of the meat that you're going to need to know what to say and do. I wish I had more time, Sandy, but I'm hopeful that's helpful to you. Call me back and let me know how things go. Until tomorrow, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.